Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking about current events in Brazil. We'll be talking a little bit about the elections that are set for this fall, perhaps review the tenure of the president, Lula da Silva, who is favored to win a second term as president. We'll also think about and talk a bit about Brazil's place in the world economy, also its potential to become one of the globe's most powerful players. And as I said before the news, I think there are certainly a lot of people who feel that it does have that potential. And our guest for the program is Francisco Ferreira. He is lead economist with the Development Research Group at the World Bank and works on poverty and inequality issues. Also, one of the editors of Economia. It's the policy journal of the Latin American and Caribbean Economic Association. It's published by the Brookings Institution Press. He was born in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, has a PhD from the London School of Economics. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we will pay for the call. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, wherever the signal will travel, or you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Ferreira, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
I wonder if I might ask you about something that certainly involves Brazil, but is larger than that, and that is the collapse of the recent round of trade talks that just has happened now within the past few days. They've been going on now for almost 5 years. This is the so-called Doha round, named for the capital of Qatar, where the talks started back in 2001. And apparently it has been officially declared to be at such an impasse that, at least at the moment, there's no point in going any further. And it seemed that the big issue here, perhaps the most difficult thing for all of the parties to agree to, has to do with agricultural commodities and how they are traded and how the prices and farmers are supported. They're apparently in a lot of places, farmers are one of the most powerful political constituencies there are around the world. And I wonder, perhaps you could talk just a little bit generally about the significance of the collapse of these talks, and then we can connect it to Brazil. And I'll ask the question, does this have some particular consequence for Brazil?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you begin the program with that, because if it weren't for the war in the Middle East, that would have been the worst news in the last couple of weeks. Now, because of the war, of course, it's not getting as much attention, but it is, and I want to emphasize for your listeners, it is very bad news for the developing world as a whole. If you remember when these talks were launched, they were described as the Millennium Round and the Development Round. Gordon Brown, who was the UK Minister of Finance, was very keen that this round would be the one that would deliver benefits for poor people in poor countries. And what we see really is the result of a lack of will by the leaders, particularly of the G7 economies, of the richest economies, to make the small compromises that would have been needed to save around. And what it means in practice is that farmers around the world, which are some of the poorest people in the developing world, will continue to compete with farmers in the developed world, which are heavily subsidized by the taxpayers in those countries. So it's inefficient and inequitable and very bad news indeed.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure there's a point in engaging in finger-pointing here, but I'll ask the question anyway, because I'm sure if we went around and talked to the various parties and said, well, who really is the problem here, that the complaint of the United States is that developing countries won't open their markets. The complaint of the developing countries is of farm subsidies that are paid to American farmers, and they no doubt have the same kind of complaints about many farmers in the EU. And so depending upon who you ask, it's always the other guy's fault. I mean, can one really say that one of the other groups, either those that represent the developed world, the industrialized countries, or those that represent the developing world, that one or the other of them is more responsible for the impasse?
I think the fact that the trade talks failed on the agricultural subject is suggestive of who may be most at fault. Because, in fact, there were offers on the table from Brazil, India, and some other developing countries to improve on the market offering in industrial products, which is what the United States and the EU ask for in return for reducing farm subsidies in the U.S. and for reducing farm tariffs in Europe. So those are the big issues in the different countries. Here, it's less a question of tariffs, and the U.S. is, in fact, alongside Brazil, Australia, India, and other agricultural exporters, the U.S. is in favor of reducing tariffs, but that's because it protects its farmers through subsidies rather than tariffs, and it has very competitive farmers in some areas. Of course, in the Midwest, with all the grains are very competitive in the U.S. It's other farmers that get protected. But you know, I would say, and I work in a development institution, so you may say that we here at the World Bank have the interests of the developing world at heart. But even so, I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, the biggest culprits for this collapse are the United States and the European Union as well, for having been inflexible. I think at the very end, it was the United States that happened to be most inflexible on reducing the farm subsidies, but Europe has traditionally been equally stubborn about protecting its farmers. These are very thorny political issues within these countries, and one understands the politics, but it doesn't really take us away from the fact that it shows that collectively these nations are not prepared, despite much, much higher standards of living, to make very small sacrifices, which would in fact be better for consumers in these countries because the price of food would fall. But it's that politically vocal group of protected farmers that's holding back what could have been a great improvement in living standards for poor people around the world.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Francisco Ferreira. He is a lead economist with the Development Research Group at the World Bank and works on issues of poverty and inequality. He is one of the editors of the policy journal of the Latin American and Caribbean Economic Association. It's called Economia. It's published by the Brookings Institution Press. And we're talking here this morning, and we'll be talking much more about Brazil, its politics and economy. And questions are welcome. And we do have someone, and rather than make them wait while I ask more questions, we will get them right into the conversation. And this is someone who is in Eureka. It is line number 4. Hello.
Thank you, David, for your courtesy. Your questions are always very pertinent and good. I'm going to ask a question, and I would like to take the answer off the air.
Okay.
Recent media reports have touted Brazil as being energy self-sufficient, at least in fuel for its automobiles, due to sugarcane. Could you comment on that and the energy resources that Brazil has? Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Go ahead.
Brazil has been famous for its ethanol program for a while, which is the program where we get ethanol gas from sugarcane. And a large number of Brazil's automobiles are converted to use a mix of ethanol and gasoline. So that helps our self-sufficiency. But in fact, what has recently happened in terms of Brazil's self-sufficiency in energy has actually been bigger discoveries of petroleum off the coast. So Brazil isn't an exporter, has never been an exporter, is in fact an importer of oil, but recently those import requirements have been falling very substantially because of new oil developments in particularly off the coast of Brazil.
Well, there, I think as I understand it, what Brazil is talking about is moving toward the point where they perhaps wouldn't have to import any oil at all, or at least they would basically power their vehicle fleet by domestically produced ethanol. In Brazil, are they looking at the possibility, because not only do they have that as a product for potential export Petroleum would be another. They do have a lot of hydropower in the country. So is it possible that we might be looking at Brazil at some point as an exporter of energy?
I honestly think that may take some time because, you know, the hope is that our economy will continue to grow. And as economies grow, as we've observed recently in China, energy requirements also grow with GDP. And as I indicate, most of the progress in self-sufficiency has recently come from oil, unless they are very big and you know, by their very nature, unexpected new discoveries. I wouldn't think that we would move into exporting, though it is true that our import requirements are now much lower, and there is some self-sufficiency. And as you pointed out, also because of hydroelectric energy, which we're traditionally very strong on, having a superb endowment of rivers. So I think the at a time when oil prices are so high around the world, Brazil is relatively comfortable now because of approaching self-sufficiency, but I don't envisage Brazil becoming a major exporter anytime soon, unless there's some very big new discovery of oil somewhere in the country.
I know that certainly today Brazil has one of the largest economies in the world. I have read different sorts of numbers as to just where exactly it places. I suppose it's at least within the top 10.
I think it's just around top 10 or 11, no. Maybe.
I suppose that's not quite as important as acknowledging the fact that it is one of those countries that, by virtue of its size, its natural resources, perhaps also growing human capital, that in future, and we're talking about here now, maybe we're talking about 20, 30 years in the future, though, that people are saying, here's one of the places that is certainly going to be a very powerful economic player in the global economy, alongside countries like India and China, perhaps also Russia. At least Russia has a great deal of natural resources, energy particularly, that they can draw on. If you think about potential for Brazil in the world economy, and we'll do a fairly long time scale, maybe let's talk 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. What do you think where do you think at that point Brazil is likely to be?
You know, as a Brazilian citizen, I would very much like to share the hope that Brazil will become a very big player. It certainly has the geographic and population endowments for that, right? We are 180 million people, which I think puts us at the fifth largest population in the world. We are very large in area. People don't often realize, but Brazil is the size of the continental United States, that is, United States without Alaska. So it's a large country. It's got a lot of people. Its GDP is not small at $560 billion. So there are some of the foundations for leadership, if you like, just in terms of those raw endowments. On the other hand, just to sound a cautionary note, which I don't like, but I feel one must honestly do, when I was growing up in Brazil in the 80s, there was a joke that, you know, Brazil has always been and will always remain the country of the future. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that for a moment, it's not a very nice scenario. And the reason is that, you know, after a very rapid period of growth in the 60s and 70s, we have been stagnant in the 80s and been growing fairly slowly in the last 15 years. And some of the reasons for that we can go into later, they have to do with the way our state is organized and the way that we intervene in economic activity and our inequality, which is very large and prevents people from being able to develop to their full potential, all sorts of different reasons. But it means that Brazil hasn't yet come anywhere near the rates of growth that you observe in India or China, or that you observe in Chile, for that matter. So it's still a little bit, it's not no longer the sleeping giant, but it's the kind of slowly awakening giant. And for us to take up that position of leadership that people expect Brazil is able to take, we would really have to continue with some of our economic reforms that we've taken half-heartedly in order to achieve more rapid rates of growth.
We have another caller in the community of Belgium, which is not all that far away from us here in Champaign-Urbana. They're on our line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'd like to approach the topic that the largest natural resource that Brazil has is the rainforest that it encompasses, and the improvements in Brazil seem to going to be coming at the malaise of the rainforest, which is going to be extremely important, or is very extremely important to all of us throughout the world. And these companies who seem to be driving the Doha are actually the same people who are benefiting from this too, in that the sugar companies here in the United States get huge, huge, huge subsidies, and it looks like Brazil grows enormous quantities of sugar that it uses to turn into alcohol, which probably has put the rainforest at its demise also. Could we discuss that just a little bit? Thank you very much, sirs.
Okay.
Shall I just jump in?
Go ahead.
That's a very interesting question. The Amazon in Brazil are often equated, and in fact, it's important to realize that just over half of the Amazon rainforest is on Brazilian territory, so the other half is in other countries, and it also accounts for about half of Brazilian territory. So there is half of the country that is nowhere near the Amazon. But you know, occupying half the land Brazil sits on, it's of course a big resource, and it's also a source of concern, as the caller indicated, because of its ecological and environmental importance for the world as a whole. And here, what I would like to suggest is the idea that Brazilian growth shouldn't be seen as an enemy of the Amazon; it should actually be seen as part of the solution for protecting the Amazon. And the reason for that is that, just like in other countries, just like in the U.S. and elsewhere, environmental awareness and a value for the environment grow as people grow more educated and as people grow richer. And in fact, one of the drivers of Amazon destruction is poverty and rural landlessness. And many of these people have been traditionally driven from land in the more developed agricultural areas to the south and end up doing slash and burn agriculture near the Amazon rainforest, some of which affects deforestation there. I don't want to convey the impression that that's the main cause of destruction in the rainforest. There is a lot of illegal logging, some of it by larger companies, some of it by smaller companies. So there are indeed, as the caller seemed to suggest, some economic interests from both Brazil and abroad that benefit from this destruction. But there is also an auxiliary driver, which is poor landless people driven up north to the only land they can find. And so more equitable development in Brazil, growth in Brazil, will, I think, help protect the Amazon rather than the reverse. And you see some of that already in the fact that the big movements, the big environmental movements in Brazil, including a number of NGOs, people who are very vocal for the protection of the Amazon, lie in the richer cities to the south, in São Paulo and Rio. So, you know, just like in Europe, just like in the U.S., a concern of the environment and the resources to protect it will come from more educated and richer people. So I think we should see development in Brazil and protection of the Amazon as complements rather than substitutes.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the president, Mr. Lula da Silva, who is now campaigning for a second term. There will be elections in Brazil in early October. And I was interested, I went back and looked at just a few of the things that had been written about him when he was campaigning the first time around back in 2002. And a lot was made of his left-wing, radical, labor activist roots. And apparently a lot of people were concerned about just what sort of policies he would adopt if he was elected. And now that he is campaigning again for his second term, people are looking at how he has done as president. It seems that for those people that were afraid that he would be too far to the left, perhaps they would say that they're pleasantly surprised. And then for those people who really wanted him to be that man, really wanted him to be aggressive in those kinds of policies, they're disappointed because apparently he certainly hasn't done that. He seems to have taken more of a kind of middle course between those two kind of poles. Is my impression generally correct?
I think it's absolutely correct, David. The Lula presidency has been remarkable in its differences from the expectations. When he was first elected, we expected a very left-wing activist that would excel in ethics in government, that would rid the country of corruption, but might pursue poor economic policies. And what we've seen has been the exact opposite of that. Very good economic policies, and I'll talk a bit more about them in a moment. Good in the sense that he's maintained macroeconomic stability, which is, by the way, and he's understood that after losing an election earlier on that basis. He's understood that low inflation is good for the poor. He's understood that his voters, the poor in Brazil, hate inflation more than the rich, for the simple reason that they could, under hyperinflation, they could never protect their savings the way the rich could. So sound macroeconomic policies in Brazil are not an anti-poor stance. But it wasn't what people were expecting. And he took the advice of the outgoing central bank president in the previous administration in how to run monetary policy. Interest rates have remained very high. We've had some of the highest real interest rates in the world, which had some costs in terms of growth, but has helped keep inflation on a downward trajectory to the point that we are now expecting an inflation rate lower than 5%, which in my lifetime has been completely unprecedented in Brazil. And on the other hand, where we expected the Workers' Party, the PT, who came from the outside, to clean up government, what we've seen instead was a major corruption scandal, equal to or worse than any of the others in Brazilian history before. So it's been an odd presidency in those two senses.
Well, it seems that as far as the corruption scandal goes, that we might say, here in the United States, that this hasn't quite stuck to the president. He seems to have said that he was not involved, and I'm not sure that how many people are holding him directly responsible. So their association with corruption is a negative. Possibly some people feeling positive about economic policy is a positive. It's still, I guess, what I read suggests that he has a very good chance of being reelected. Do you indeed think that chances are he probably will win a second term?
I think there's a very good chance that he will. I think that chance is a little bit smaller than current poll numbers suggest because the trend in the polls are against him. But, you know, if I had to put money on it, he would still be favorite to win. Although I think it's now very likely there will be a second round. You know, Brazilian elections, as in some other countries, if the most voted candidate in the first round doesn't have more votes than the sum of his opponents, then there will be a runoff election a month later, which is actually an interesting institutional feature. Brazilian institutions have a number of problems, but this one's a very good one, and it helps resolve the kinds of problems that you have in Mexico now, for instance, where there's a very disputed election that's very close in a three-way race. Mm-hmm. So he's still favored to win. You know, I think if you ask Brazilians of all walks of life, regions and colors, whether they think Lula really didn't know about what was going on in the election, in the corruption scandal, and just for the benefit of listeners that might not know very much about that, that was basically a vote-buying scandal whereby parliamentarians were paid large sums of money for voting alongside with the government. And it then, once that was investigated, it led to discoveries of earlier corruption in municipal governments administered by the PT, where there was basically racketeering with private companies that had to pay for their contracts and garbage collection and that sort of thing. So very widespread network of corruption in a party that we really didn't expect would have it. Now, I think, as I was saying, if you ask people, do you really believe the president did not know? I think no one would answer that they believe that. But what does happen is that more than half of the Brazilian population has been experiencing big increases in their living standards, and that's the poorer half. And it comes from two things. The pattern of Brazilian growth over the last 6 or 7 years has been what we call pro-poor, in the sense that the poor have been growing much faster than the average and than the rich. So, you know, it's the opposite of that thing we always say, that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. For a while now in Brazil, that has not been happening, which is very good news. It started before Lula, but has certainly continued under his government. And in addition to that, he's created some social programs that redirect transfers to the very poor. So a combination of those two factors makes a number of people say, well, you know, this guy is a bit corrupt. Maybe he knew about all that. But, you know, the ones that came before him were corrupt, too. And at least we're doing better now.
Yeah. Well, he certainly, that is where it is among the most disadvantaged people where he has drawn his strength in his campaign to be reelected. He seems also to have turned to that constituency asking for their support again. And certainly I remember when he assumed office at the beginning, he made some rather bold promises about what he would do to try to deal with hunger and with poverty and to try to improve conditions for the most disadvantaged people of Brazil. He has at least in part fulfilled those kinds of promises?
I think so, David. And I think for those people who are interested in social policy issues, this has again been an interesting presidency. Lula began with great marketing on the zero hunger proposal that he made. It became instantly known everywhere in Brazil and also very well known abroad, and he was often welcomed at international meetings as, you know, the president that will end hunger in Brazil. It turns out, in practice, his government's initial ideas of how to address that problem were very seriously flawed. They were outdated ideas about delivering food, you know, in kind, actual food baskets to people, opening popular restaurants and places. When all that we've learned in the last 20 years about successful social policy in developing countries suggests that distributing cash directly, often through smart cards, which, you know, even in a country like Brazil, almost everyone can have access, if not in their own towns, in a nearby town, to a banking network where they can get the cash from those cards. And often that cash is conditional on things like keeping your kids in school or keeping your kids up to date with their vaccines, what people call conditional cash transfers. That's, you know, the Rolls Royce nowadays, whereas delivering food baskets by helicopter, except in a situation of conflict or natural disaster, is not really recommended as a normal means of social policy. And what the Lula administration did, to its credit, is within the first year, it realized its original ideas were failing. It changed the minister and adopted these ideas that were very foreign to them, but adopted them on the basis that they saw them working elsewhere in Mexico and Bangladesh and Colombia. So you don't hear about zero hunger very much anymore. You hear about Bolsa Família, which is the name in Brazil for these conditional cash transfers. So, you know, and some recent work suggests that Bolsa Família is accounting for almost a quarter of the reduction in inequality in Brazil. This is one of the most unequal countries in the world, but inequality has been falling a little bit in the last 4 years. And again, it began before Lula, but he's been part of the continuation of that process. Mm.
We are just a bit past our midpoint. We have several callers we will get right to. Our guest for this hour, Francisco Ferreira. He is lead economist with the Development Research Group at the World Bank and works on poverty and inequality issues. He's one of the editors of Economia. It's the policy journal of the Latin American and Caribbean Economic Association. It's published by the Brookings Institution Press. He holds PhD from the London School of Economics, has also taught economics at the university level. He is Brazilian himself. He was born in Sao Paulo. And we're talking about politics and economy of Brazil. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next in line is in Champaign County and line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, I'd like to start out by just saying there are many people that are extremely suspicious of anybody associated with the World Bank, since we see it as a political device, given the way money was just cut for the government of Ethiopia after the EU tried to condition their money so that it wasn't going to support the government as directly. But that's just sort of the context that I wanted to develop. I don't see the World Bank as being the premier development agency in the world at all. going back to the point that the earlier caller raised about the connection to the Amazon, just recently we've had this illustration of Greenpeace Brazil shaming Cargill and some of the other big multinationals, Bunge, I believe, was included in it, at taking soya that was grown very directly on recently slashed and burned rainforest area. So it seems to me that, you know, your statistics about how much rainforest isn't in Brazil and all that was not very, very, very to the point. There is a definite connection with this cash cropping economy that has generally been exposed, supported by the World Bank. And I think the argument about the alcohol, there's quite a bit of alcohol used for transportation in Brazil. They've been insulated from the oil shock to some extent. And I dare say that I don't know the statistics about these new oil fines, but I'm questioning whether that is also sort of an obscuring kind of statistic. It's actually very clear that a non-cash crop, a direct growth for production for use, has been very fundamental for probably keeping the Brazilian economy in a situation where they can allow more gains for the poor.
Shall I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Would I like to respond to any of those
respond.
3 points,
yeah.
I guess?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, the caller is right. The World Bank is a political institution, and many people have doubts about it. We like to think of ourselves in the research department as being relatively independent. But whether the caller believes that or not is obviously not something I'll manage to change in the next 5 minutes. You know, my point about half the Amazon being in Brazil, the other half not being in Brazil, was merely what the geography of the situation is. What I really try to say was that you should see development in Brazil as compatible with protection for the Amazon. And Greenpeace Brazil that he referred to is an example of the sorts of people I was mentioning. It's very well-educated people in the South, typically, that participate in it. Now, yes, there is absolutely right. There's some of the destruction in the Amazon is by large companies, as I said. I think the cash cropping that he referred to may be part of it. Even worse is the logging, some of which is sold internationally and has support by international agencies. It does not have any support from the World Bank. And those are big problems. And a stronger Brazilian state that has the capacity to control the Amazon, to investigate crimes that are committed against the national park areas and against the forest, is needed. So I'm not suggesting that growth alone is a solution either. We need more active policy in protecting the Amazon. What I was hoping to suggest was that the idea that Brazilian growth will be bad for the Amazon because as it grows, it will encroach further into the forest. That's what I think is often a common misconception. So that's what I say about that. About the ethanol, there's no particular reason the World Bank or I would be more interested in petroleum than ethanol. Ethanol has been a successful program, and I think it's been a very good program. It did not, unfortunately, insulate Brazil from the oil shock, as the caller suggested in the past. In fact, our debt crisis that began in 1982 began in large part through our failure to adjust to the increases in the price of oil and the financing that was provided by petrodollars in the shocks of 1973 and in particular 1979. And it didn't insulate us because it's an important program, but it did not make us self-sufficient in oil and in energy. And now the new discoveries of petroleum have helped to do that.
Did you want to follow up?
Well, just referring to the failure of the ethanol program in 1973 is more than a little silly, it seems to me. I'm talking about the insulation. You won't say that it would have been worse. Would have been less bad if this amount of ethanol wasn't used for transport. I mean, clearly it has had some effect, and
it
underlies the whole idea that lesser developed countries need to produce for themselves, and they have to stop accepting the IMF and the World Bank. These are 30-year-old prescriptions too, but the ones that suggest that they should grow cash crops for the northern market.
I'm not suggesting that, and I don't think anybody else here is either. In fact, you know, just so we are talking about correct facts, sugarcane, which is where ethanol comes from, is a cash crop, and most of it is grown by very large farmers. But you know, I don't have a particular position on ethanol. I think it's a great program. I think ethanol is a great program, and I didn't refer to the failure of ethanol in 73. I referred to the oil shock in 73.
You said that it didn't insulate Brazil against the oil shock at that time. Obviously, it that you were referring to was the ethanol program that probably was in its infancy, if it had even been born in those days. Obviously, sugar is a cash crop, but the Brazilians are exporting quite a bit less since they're using it to fuel their cars. I think I'll sign off. Thanks.
All right. Anything else? Any last comment you want to make on that, this particular subject, before I go on?
No, I mean, I think the ethanol program is a good program. It was created in response to the oil shocks, in fact, after 79. So, you know, clearly it couldn't have insulated Brazil against that shock. But what I meant was that, you know, it was never large enough to meet all of Brazil's energy needs. Neither would it ever be, because it uses up a lot of land. And in fact, you know, as I think your caller would sympathize with, Brazilians need that land to grow food on. Mm-hmm. So the ethanol is part of the solution. And the other part are these discoveries of oil and hydroelectric power and so on.
Well, let's go on to another caller. Next will be Pisotum, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
I'm somewhat familiar with some of the farms in Brazil, especially the Mato Grosso area. And it was a surprise to me as we made visits there that how much farmers are controlled by environmental law in Brazil, much more so, in fact, than what we are here in the States. I also farm here. In fact, a friend of mine who lives in around Campo Novo in Mato Grosso, which is the west central part of Brazil, soybean frontier, basically. And that's the Cerrado, which is not the Amazon forest. But yet, he is only allowed in Mato Grosso to clear 65% of the land he owns. He has to leave 35% set as a set-aside. And then if you go up to the Amazon, actual Amazon, state of Amazonia, if you own land there and you want to farm it, you can only clear 20%, and you have to leave 80%. And I don't know if it's that way in Amazonia, but in Mato Grosso, he's no longer to burn what he does clear in the open. He can cut it up for firewood and sell it that way. But things have really changed. It's a lot different what people think Brazil is really like when you have to actually farm there. But the other point I wanted to ask you about was a couple of things. Number one is, he's really hurting now, and most anyone who's exporting, in particular agriculture, is really hurting because of the devalued dollar or the increase in the value of the real. And you know, how long is that going to continue? Because if it does continue on, they're not going to plant as many acres of soybeans. They're going to do something else. They'll plant sugarcane, make ethanol probably. That's my one question. And then the other is, I've been confronted with people who have told me here in the last week that Brazil has actually spent $1 billion on farm subsidies. And I think what they're referring to is an auction buy-up of cheap soybeans to try to help farmers out who are really hurting as far as because of the devalued dollar. And in fact, there's been demonstrations parking tractors in front of banks and all this kind of thing. So if you wouldn't mind commenting on those items, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Those are excellent questions. I think your point about environmental legislation in Brazil is a very good one, and I think you're right. People often don't realize the extent to which there already is legislation about those things. The problem in that sector, as in many others in Brazil, is the divide between the law and the reality. And so the people you've met and your friends down there probably obey the law, but there are many, many people who don't. In this area, as in other areas, in our labor laws and a number of other forms of regulation in Brazil. So often the problem in Brazil is the gap between a very nice set of legislations on paper and real practice. And as I was indicating earlier in my reply to the other caller, the same is true in the Amazon. The legislations for protecting the Amazon look fantastic on paper, but people violate them, and illegal loggers in particular. And I mention them in particular because when they open the roads, not only do they take up the logs, but by opening the roads, they open the way for cattle ranchers and other agriculturalists that are not obeying the law in the way that the people you met in Mato Grosso are. And that is where some of the problem is. So, yeah, the problem in Brazil isn't a lack of political will to make the law. It's a lack of resources and political will to enforce it. And I think that's where action is needed. You raised the question of the appreciated real, which is a very topical question in Brazil at the moment. Our Minister of Finance, who has changed recently, the previous minister having been one of the casualties of the corruption scandal. The current Minister of Finance is talking about starting a process of devaluation for the real, which exporters in Brazil are very keenly demanding. The real has appreciated a lot. It's difficult to say that it's really overvalued because we are still running a very substantial current account surplus, meaning not only do we export a lot more than we import, we also export more than what we import and have to pay out in interest on debt and other foreign obligations. So when a country sustains a current account surplus, one typically doesn't say that its currency is overvalued because, you know, demand for the products at that price still outweighs demand for imports. But it is a topical and difficult economic issue in Brazil now, the management of the exchange rate. Personally, I think that the central bank ought to continue a policy of letting the real float, at least while we still maintain a current account surplus. It is proving difficult for a number of our exporters, but on the other hand, exports in Brazil have grown so much over the last 10 years that there's clearly been a lot of learning going on. There's clearly a lot of competitiveness that has been acquired by the country, and that is what, in some sense, makes the real be the value that it is.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Francisco Ferreira. He's an economist with the Development Research Group of the World Bank. We're talking about Brazil, and questions are welcome. We have a couple of others. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next in line is in Kankakee. This is line 4. Hello.
Your caller apologizes if it's already been covered, but he tuned in just before the guest was reintroduced, a little before or after the half past hour. Could the guest indicate how great are the prospects for the preservation and productive use of the Amazonian rainforest by sustaining harvest of trees, medicinals, and the host of other rainforest resources? Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, we were talking a little bit about the Amazon before, and I think you were pointing to a set of policies and practices that can indeed be instrumental in protecting the Amazon. And I think the call is referring to the sort of combined extraction and preservation activities that can happen around a series of fruits and nuts, some forms of harvesting rubber, from rubber trees, and a number of these practices are indeed supported by the local inhabitants of the Amazon rainforest, who have traditionally had occupations around rubber tapping or cashew nut collections and so on. And so when deforestation comes their way, it's a threat not only to the environment around them and an environment resource that's important for the whole world, but also to their direct livelihoods. So I think because of the positive externalities, as economists would call them, that are associated with protecting those activities, I think there is a role for the state in supporting them where necessary, because in some cases, for instance, rubber it will never be competitive at world prices when it's collected that way, because it'll be competing with synthetics and much cheaper rubber from elsewhere. But because the activity has both a social and an ecological value, it may be worthwhile for governments to consider whether some support is not required. So I think, you know, that set of practices is very creative and innovative approach, which I think can help the social fabric and the environment in the Amazon, particularly if coupled with more effective enforcement of the laws against logging, cattle farming in the Amazon.
We have time for one more caller here. We'll go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I heard that Citigroup, for example, was making very large profits in Brazil. So I was curious if your guest could talk about which corporations that we would call American are really big in Brazil. And then two, and then I'll hang up. I also heard that last year there was a, on the cultural, artistic end of things, a hit soap opera in Brazil called America, and that one of the subplots involved a Brazilian couple who were having problems adapting to the American way of life and with the schooling of their son, which makes me wonder if there's anything you could say about what the Brazilian general notion of America might be, at least in the arts. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Those are very interesting questions. On Citigroup, banks as a whole, the whole banking sector, is very profitable in Brazil despite being competitive. And the main reason for that are the very high real interest rates that Brazil charges and are therefore translated into fairly high banking spreads. So, Citigroup is profitable, as are a number of other American and Brazilian banks, as well as European banks there. In terms of other companies, other U.S. Transnationals that are big in Brazil, you know, there's so many. I wouldn't know where to start. There are big car makers, of course, that have plants there. All of the computing industries, you know, IBM. So there's a whole host of companies. Brazil is fairly well integrated into the foreign direct investment flows, and so it has a large presence of corporate America there. On your second question, which is very interesting, you know, I think the way to describe it candidly is that Brazil and Brazilians have a love-hate relationship with the United States. American culture, American movies, American music are very, very popular. And if you go to certain shopping malls in the big cities in Rio or São Paulo or even some of the other cities, you might be forgiven for thinking you are in the United States, except for the language that's being spoken and the language on the signs. On the other hand, politically, people are very wary of U.S. foreign policy, in large part because of what U.S. foreign policy was like during our dictatorship and the support of the U.S. for dictatorships in Latin America in the past. Today, if you take opinion polls, upwards of 80 or 90% would have opposed the Iraq war and would have a very poor view of American foreign policy today. So it's that funny combination that you'll find across Latin America, in fact, of a great ease of living with American culture and American products and American arts, and everyone learning English, or everyone that can afford it learning English, I should say. But at the same time, a very great suspicion of what people call U.S. imperialism in Latin America, and you know, which the Iraq War and now even the Israeli war against Lebanon do not do anything to reduce.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I'm sure in the United States there was concern and suspicion when Mr. Lula da Silva was elected, thinking about what sort of policies he would adopt and what the relationship would be between Brazil and the United States. And then it took someone like Hugo Chavez to show them perhaps maybe Mr. Lula da Silva wasn't such a bad guy and was somebody that they could work with. It, just very quickly, what can you say about the relationship between Brazil and the U.S.?
Well, apparently, both of these presidents are people to whom personal relations matter, and apparently they've hit it off. So I think that helped at a very basic level. Bush and Lula can talk to each other, and I think President Bush finds that Lula is someone he can trust. In addition to that, as you indicated, economic policy in Brazil was not what it was feared to be, and Brazil is a very reliable financial and trading partner for the United States.
Well, there we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, Francisco Ferreira, he's lead economist with the Development Research Group at the World Bank. And to you, Dr. Ferreira, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.